Welcome, investors, to the Absolute Return Podcast, your source for stock market analysis, global macro musings, and hedge fund investment strategies. Your hosts, Julian Klimochko and Michael Kesslering, aim to bring you the knowledge and analysis you need to become a more intelligent and wealthier investor. This episode is brought to you by Accelerate Financial Technologies. Accelerate, because performance matters. Find out more at accelerateshares.com.
Welcome, podcast listeners, to the Absolute Return Podcast. I am Julian Klimochko. I'm here with my co-host, Mike Kesslering. And in today's podcast, we welcome special guests, Robert Diorio and Jeffrey Lin of Diorio Wealth Management, where Robert is vice president and portfolio manager, and Jeffrey is associate advisor. On the podcast, our guests discuss the growth investing mindset, portfolio construction, how the wealth management business is changing, and even some of their favorite stock picks. So with no further ado, please welcome Robert Diorio and Jeffrey Lin. So we have Rob and Jeff on the podcast today. Thank you, gentlemen, for coming on the Absolute Return Podcast. Really happy to have you on the show today to talk about growth investing, hedging, wealth management, and all that entails in 2020, which was certainly a very interesting year. Now, to start things off, why don't you tell our listeners a bit about your background and how you initially got interested in investing?
Sure. Thanks. First of all, thanks, Julian, for inviting Jeff and I. We're really excited to be here. I mean, I've been in this industry since I graduated from undergrad. I'm very sad to say that I have not worked for any other company or industry in my life. I was recruited out of university, was one of the lucky ones. This was back in like 1999 when everything was booming. And, I'm also from a family of misguided entrepreneurs who've made many mistakes in my life. So I was always interested on investing and planning and that sort of stuff. So I've been in this for that long. So it's been over 20 years now.
Jeff, for sure. So I'm similar to Rob, actually. I started straight out of university. It was a little bit more recently for me. I started in 2014, so I'm a little more junior in the industry. I worked for Rob and the team, you know, the entire time. My entire experience in the industry has been with him and here. I kind of started the first few years going after a little bit more, let's say, higher education. Did an MBA, did the CFA, got all kind of that formal schooling out of the way. That was a bit of a grind, working, studying full-time for 3 years. Once that was done with, you know, I'm glad to say that's behind me. I'd say what first got me kind of interested in investing was, I think my first experience with investing was, I think, what would it have been? I would have been just 18 years old. I had just opened my first, direct investing account. And I had decided that at that time, BlackBerry was very prominent in the world. They were reporting earnings that night. And I said, you know what, the last few times this has been really good. So I just blindly put in like $1,000 or something into BlackBerry, and it was down 30% the next day.
Oh no!
So that was a big that was a bit of a shock, and I think it kind of got me hooked because I wanted to understand, how I could have made that mistake, but then also just understand what makes stocks tick and that kind of thing. So I'd say that got me started on the path, and I've always kind of been interested ever since.
Yeah, so Jeff, actually, I was just going to say that that was actually my first investment as well, was BlackBerry. And that very same thing that had happened to you, I believe there was about a month lag time in my case, but the exact same experience with BlackBerry. So we share that in common.
We weren't wrong. We were just early. It was up 50% yesterday, I think, at one point. I thought we were just 12 years early. That's all.
Yeah, exactly.
Just 12 years. In terms of portfolio construction, how do you think about that in the context of your investing?
So, portfolio construction is, for us, it's all about principles and methodology. We're really academic about this. We don't want any emotions to get into the way. So, we're growth investors. So we try and focus primarily on, let's call it generational companies as the core of our portfolio. And so, in order to do that, you have to also have rules, and so we actually did a blog a while back, actually earlier this year, called the DM5, which are five core our methodology for how we do things. And the bottom of the list, and probably the most important, is you know, I talk about this a lot, is having core beliefs. So you have to have a belief in what you're doing. And so for us, if we're going to, you know, for growth and we want to grow our assets, we believe in compound interest, then we have to have a clear why. So what's the why is, you know, we want to invest in stuff we believe in. So that's where that generational kind of focus at the core of the portfolio. And of course, you know, the other four rules are, you know, pre-established game plan. So I think that's integral, because we all know that you can make decisions when you have a clear mind, but when there's a fire in the theater, people don't always leave the theater in an orderly fashion. And of course, you have to document everything. That's our second rule, especially the mistakes. And so we tend not only to learn from our mistakes, but we want to make sure that we don't repeat them. And then third is it's the good habits rule. So as a portfolio manager, you better have a ton of good habits and very few bad ones. And then lastly is procedural. We call it the procedural trust rule. We're essentially trying to be procedural on everything. So when it comes to sizing our positions, you know, what we use to get our idea generation, I mean, we can write a whole thesis on this. I don't know, Jeff, if you want to add to this, but yeah. That's kind of how we think of portfolio management. It's got to be very, very structural.
Yeah, I think it all kind of comes down to taking emotion and taking, let's say, on-the-fly decision-making out of the equation as much as possible, right? So have pre-established plans and rules and rules kind of in place. I think especially, you know, when it comes to processes that you can do, there's always, you know, a certain amount of needing to monitor what's going on and adapting to what's going on. But when it comes to things like, for example, clients who add new money or who transfer cash over or who open a new account, you know, what's the plan for getting their money invested? You know, if you start questioning and saying, well, now's not the right time, or market, you know, things have been moving up for a while now, maybe we should wait. If you end up either waiting too long or you become kind of paralyzed by, by whatever's going on at the given time. So having rules in place, and we have kind of a whole system for let's say new capital deployment that we've developed in terms of, you know, time-based rules that'll say, you know, put X amount to work at these time intervals, regardless of what's going on. So you're never sitting on your hands for too long, not doing anything. But also, you know, allows us to give us a little bit of flexibility. We have some market-based rules, like if ever, you know, indices are 10% off the highs, then it's an automatic buy of X percent of capital. If it's 15, if it's 20, we have different rules in place to kind of, as much as we can, take emotion out of the equation.
Yeah, and that's certainly an important characteristic, being systematic with respect to your investment process, having rules and procedures in place such that Q1 2020, specifically March, happens, the quickest bear market of all time. You know, you don't have people panic selling and you're trying to perhaps, be somewhat counter-cyclical and capitalizing on the situation with built-in rules, such that, you know, the human brain isn't necessarily built to be an investor, because it always wants to do the bad thing, buy high, sell low, right? So having an unbiased and an unemotional approach certainly makes sense. Now, Rob, you indicated you're focused on growth investing, generational growth type opportunities. What do you personally find appealing about growth investing, and what aspects of it really resonates with clients?
Yeah, so this goes back a long way. I talked about, you know, Jeff talked about his experience with BlackBerry. I think of, you know, my experience as a teenager analyzing. My mom worked for Bell Canada. She was an executive there, and she had a stock purchase plan, obviously, and she didn't understand much about it. So what did she do? She spoke to us about it. And of course, my brother, being in the medical field, didn't really care too much about it, but I instantly was interested. So I you know, took the time to understand it. And as a teenager, I analyzed it. And then the first thing that occurred to me was, compound interest is the most powerful force in the universe. And so for me, it's been ingrained that you got to reinvest the dividends, because I saw what that can do with the stock plan. And I was shocked. I was absolutely shocked at the results, right? And so was my mother, by the way. And then it goes back to kind of the first book I read in the industry. It was not yours, Julian. Yours was very good, but it was One Up on Wall Street by Peter Lynch, which I'm sure you're
classic.
Familiar with.
Yep, for sure.
It's a classic. It's an absolute classic.
Definitely recommended.
Yeah, and it's it was the power of compounding and the power of these generational companies, and looking around you and having your eyes open to see what your kids are buying, what your wife's interested in, and then realizing, you know, what's the TAM of that, and how big could this opportunity become? And so that to me, and you asked me, you know, what do I find appealing about growth investing? It's the beauty of compounding, and not just compounding dividends. We're talking about 5x, 10x. It's that 10x, that feeling of doing your first 10x. And Jeff and I would tell you that's an awesome feeling. That's what really gets us going. And, you know, and it's also aligned with our beliefs. So it's really a nice thing to do.
Yeah, so I think like Rob mentioned, what kind of always made me drawn towards it was really the whole process of looking at companies, especially let's say, you know, more junior companies and not necessarily small cap, but let's say mid cap or emerging spaces or emerging, you know, trends or developments and kind of in the world and how we live, looking at companies that are kind of addressing them, trying to like reverse engineer, you know, what's total addressable market, what's a reasonable percentage of that this company could capture, and then just work backwards and figure out, well, what does that equate to on like, you know, with reasonable multiples in terms of what their market value could be, and then what their market cap could be, and then, you know, work backwards and what's their market cap today and allocate capital that way. It's almost the simplicity to a certain extent. It's not that it's a simple process, almost the simplicity of the idea behind it or the structure of trying to find things that have the potential to grow into, you know, multiple magnitudes larger than they are today down the line. That's kind of what always drew me towards it.
Yeah, Charlie Munger always said simple, but not easy, because then everyone would do it. And it certainly is not easy. And you touched on Peter Lynch's book, One Up on Wall Street. I always liked Lynch's idea of buy what you know. You know, he'd look at certain consumer products that were catching on, still early stage, and have this long growth runway. And one company that obviously is a massive hit with consumers and the stock market is Tesla, Elon Musk, you know, an absolute rock star. I think the second wealthiest in the world at this point, just given his Tesla stock is worth over $100 billion or something crazy like that.
Yeah.
And it was just a new company, call it, you know, 10, 12 years ago. And certainly super successful, great products. You know, I don't own one personally, but you see them out on the street and they do look pretty phenomenal with great reviews. And it's really somewhat of a battleground stock. I'm on Twitter and there's a ton of Tesla bears on there, you know, short sellers, things of that nature. And then on the flip side of the coin, you know, a few bulls on the stock, which obviously have been richly rewarded this year. I believe it's up over 500% in 2020, which is absolutely bonkers. So shooting the lights out in the midst of a pandemic and worth pretty much more than the entire rest of the industry combined nearly. So you have certain thoughts on Tesla. What do you think this story presents to investors? You know, it's been a big winner for you. Do you continue to like the stock?
Yeah, so Elon has a place in our hearts for sure. He's helped us compound some of that generational wealth. But again, you know, we talked about generational companies. So when you think of generational companies of the past, you think of you know, companies like Apple or Microsoft, who are still relevant today. But obviously the one of today that most people think of is Tesla. And so when you think of Elon, he gets on stage, you know, when he unveils the Model Y, and we talk about car manufacturers, but really we all know it's not really a car manufacturer. And so what Elon does really well is he articulates, you know, what he's excited about. And he's not excited about the model. He's excited about the move towards sustainable transport. And so he starts off, and as bad as a presenter he is, because he's terrible, he starts off every, you know, unveiling with that. And so for me, you know, when you talk about having a clear why, I don't see a company that's more laser focused on this clear why than Tesla. And so we don't know if it'll continue to outperform. Our target, you know, for I think two or three years ago was a half a trillion in market cap. Well, guess what? We got there way earlier than we thought. But, you know, it has all the characteristics of a generational company. So it stays in our portfolio and it stays as a modest rate. I don't think it'd be responsible of us as portfolio managers to let it get out of hand. But for sure, it's going to be a core holding for us.
Yeah, I mean, we've owned it for a long time. I think we owned it since it was $250 the first time. And that was like, you know, pre-split. It kind of got back there very briefly this year. And now it's back, I think, above 500 again. But it's been, you know, battleground is definitely the right word for it in terms of the opinions, let's say, online. It's there doesn't seem to be many people that will kind of walk the neutral stance on Tesla. I don't see very many, like, you know, market weight or sector perform ratings on it, right? It's interesting. I mean, you know, some people would have had you believe it's been on the verge of collapse essentially since it was since it was incorporated, since it went public. And other people would believe, you know, would have you believe that it's a, you know, it's a not a, it's got plenty of runway left to run. So I mean, for us, my current outlook on it is kind of, I'm positive. I've seen the whole comparison charts where you see the, you know, the picture of Tesla's market cap on one side, and then you see all the other auto manufacturers together, all like in their own little squares together, being smaller than, you know, than this giant Tesla square on the left. It's definitely something that, you know, I think there's what people are underappreciating to a certain extent is maybe the non-automobile manufacturing side of the company. So let's say energy, storage, you know, battery production, and kind of the whole, that whole side of things. I think it was, you know, Elon Musk has come out and said this, his stated goal is eventually that will be 50% of revenues. It's not even close. I think it's around, you know, 8% right now compared to auto revenues. So there's obviously, if he's right, and, you know, he's not necessarily always right on time, but he tends to, so far he's been right over time. If that happens, there's obviously a big market that they can continue to grow into there. It's growing around 50% year over year. I think the revenues on that side of things, you know, you see all these utility projects that they're doing in Australia and France. I think even in Canada, I saw Alberta was buying like 50 mega packs or whatever their Tesla product is that are going to go in. And, you know, Alberta seems to be the last place almost that would have seemed interested in that, let's say, you know, from on the surface level. But, you know, they're obviously getting involved in certain other projects, and there's the whole self-driving side. Are they going to eventually maybe be a manufacturer of batteries and supply other EV companies with their batteries and just make, you know, not necessarily making cars, but still making, you know, profit on other cars, essentially, you know, other manufacturers' cars. So there's other areas. And I think, you know, I think looking at it just solely as an auto manufacturer, it's hard to justify much more upside. But if you start to think of these other, you know, areas and other, you know, verticals that they can get into, it starts to become more interesting. But like Rob said, you know, managing the weight, managing the exposure is key.
Jeff, you're probably talking to one of the only guys who's neutral on the stock. I understand, you know, the bear case, they talk about valuation and things of that nature, accounting, but then on the bull case, obviously tremendous product, iconic CEO who's accomplished a ton and really innovated. And one of the interesting aspects, you talk about the future growth runway above and beyond just auto manufacturing to all these different verticals. One example that, you know, I caution the bears on is you take Amazon, for example. 10 years ago, they're just pretty much internet retailer. Now, a giant portion of their valuation is the cloud Amazon Web Services, which, yeah, you know, grew out of nothing. And that was really the product of an exceptional CEO. Now, could Elon, you know, pull off something like that? Ultimately, who knows? But, you know, it's tough to bet against because he does have the market on his side. And that theory of reflexivity, won by George Soros, comes into play, where it's not the fundamentals affecting the stock, but the stock affecting the stock influencing the fundamentals, such that the stock, yeah, price has a great valuation. He has easy access to capital, and that can just boost the company's progress. Now, with that in mind, obviously, you guys are continue to hold Tesla, you like its growth prospects and outlook. What other areas of the market are you excited about? Could be sectors, could be specific names.
Yeah, I think we can talk specific names. I mean, you know, I keep on saying we have generational holds in our portfolio. So those are companies that we like to overweight and kind of think of as the core of what's going to drive. So, you know, clearly you mentioned Amazon. That's another name we're comfortable talking about that we've owned for a long time. But more, you know, I guess more on the, you know, and of course, companies like Facebook, we're still very constructive on, very good valuation. Google, of course, is, and Apple have been holdings for us for years. But so you, on the newer front, well, it's not that new for us, but more people are getting familiar with Teladoc. We think on the healthcare side, Teladoc in the recent, obviously, merger with Livongo is going to be a force in the connected health side. And I'm really excited about Uber. I know this is controversial, but I think Uber has all the character. And I'm not talking financials. I don't want to talk about, you know, earnings or anything like that. I just want to talk about the potential to be a generational company. So, you know, Tesla for me resembles Apple. And Apple, the stages of Apple's growth went from denial to hate to, you know, this product is inferior, to the whole world accepting and the ecosystem being established as the only ecosystem you want to use, right? I mean, it's debatable because of Google and other things, but and Android, but let's face it, Apple is the number one, you know, service company in the world right now. So and that's what Tesla feels like. So Uber to me feels like they have the potential, and we're not sure, to accomplish that, in their space. And that's really this another service area. Let's call it, you know, Uber everything. It's a verb, really. It's not really, I'm just going to Uber. I'm going to Uber food. I'm going to Uber a ride. I'm, Uber anything. I mean, I think that is something we really need to keep an eye on. So it has a place for us in the portfolio. We just don't know how big that can be. Maybe Jeff, you want to talk about some of your ideas on stuff that we're kind of bullish on? Or?
Yeah, sure. I'll give a name as well. I mean, I think a trend, first of all, that is pretty interesting to me is the move. Let's say you've had the whole transition to cloud and digitization of enterprise, but now, as you know, all this data is being centralized on the cloud. There's more problems about in terms of, let's say, latency and about like the actual computing that needs to occur, let's say, at the end user. So we'll call it the edge computing sector, right? So the actual computing that's being done on the device side, not central cloud, but let's say, you know, in front of the end user. So, you know, there's latency, there's all these problems. And if you're thinking about things like self-driving cars and all, and, you know, you're not necessarily going to have the ability for these cars to go and pull data from the cloud to make their decisions on what's going to happen, if you're in a life or death situation or something like that, right? So, you know, there's a company that we've been, you know, kind of investing in and getting more constructive on over time is Fastly. It's a big performer this year as well. It's up a lot year to date, but I mean, we bought it, I'd say mid 2019 or early 2019, probably. We started our position in it. And so that's one, you know, we find that, you know, they're very related to the whole edge computing side of things. You can say they're also, you know, they have ties to cybersecurity and things like that too. So they're operating in a few niches, but you know, I think that it's a name that's in a very interesting space, and it's had, you know, it's had its fair share of headlines as well. It was involved with TikTok as being its largest client. TikTok was going through a whole situation about being able to be permitted to be used in the U.S. and things like that. So that seems to be, you know, moving behind it. But I believe that they did lose them pretty much as a client at some point. So there has been a correction in the shares. But, you know, we're pretty constructive on it long term as having a long runway to, you know, even if they're losing a large client like that, I think the runway for growth is more than going to offset that over time. So that's another name we're pretty interested in.
And when you're looking at that sort of growth, it really becomes a necessity to take such a long-term approach. Number one, to actually let the business model play out, but as well as you both had mentioned, kind of the really focus on the compounding aspect of an investment throughout the horizon. That's how real wealth is made. And so, especially within, you know, very high growth investing, where, you know, there will be volatility in these names. So in terms of how do you think about, you'd mentioned your Tesla positioning where it's more of a modest position now relative to historically, perhaps. How do you think about position sizing and where you're taking emotion out of investing? Do you have systematic rules or anything of that nature?
Yeah, we do. So I'll let Jeff talk about the kind of the rules and how they work and how he applies them. But I'll just talk about, you know, we have our, well, one, we pay for a few third-party AI services. Okay. And so we need that for idea generation, and we need that also for metrics that helps us manage. So, but we have our own proprietary scoring system that Jeff runs. And so based on, you know, a criteria, there's multiple criteria, and stocks get scored proportionally to criteria we think are most important. Some could be based on fundamentals, some on technical, some on other things. So I'll let Jeff talk a little bit about that. But more importantly, Mike, when you run a portfolio, because I love this question, it sounds like we're taking outsized risk. It sounds like we're investing and we don't care about multiples. That's actually false. We do care. We're aware of them. And so you have to overlay, you have to have an overlay or a hedging capability when it comes to being a growth investor. So you have to be able to put on the brakes when things get a little out of hand. You have to be able to reel things in. And so the rebalancing process has to be unemotional. We talk about, you know, humans being flawed. Julian didn't use that term, but I use it often. Humans are flawed. They make emotional decisions. They make very quick decisions, not based on criteria. So we don't want to be the, you know, we want to have the pre-established game plan. So we do have the ability to hedge all of our portfolios. We did use that earlier this year. We were one of the lucky ones that had it on during the beginnings of the pandemic. That's just the criteria we decide based on where volatility is and based on where the cost is for that. So that's an extra layer that I just wanted to highlight, because I think if you're going to be a growth investor, you better have the tools to protect yourself. And you better have the ability to choose a good manager, like what Julian does, you know, in his products and how he's, you know, how they're looking at, you know, in the alt space, creating the just the right mix of alts, which are different from, have a different standard deviation from the rest of the portfolio. I think that is key. You know, having that in the portfolio is key. I don't know, Jeff, if you want to elaborate on how we keep the sizing modest.
Yeah. So, I mean, at the end of the day, there's you have to develop a system, and it's, you can make it as complex or as simple as you want, but I mean, we've come up with, you know, sizes of different, you know, let's say starting sizes. Obviously things move constantly, so, you know, your position is never the exact same size as when you initiate it within a day, right? But, you know, we have ranges and we have sizes that it will allow things to fluctuate within. And in terms of, you know, we have, you can call them rating systems, essentially 1, 2, and 3, and you know, these categorizations of whether something's a 1, 2, or 3 are based on different factors. So we'll look at, you know, we'll give things numerical scores related to, you know, what we feel about like technicals. So if there's certain, you know, moving averages and things that will follow, if it checks a lot of the boxes there, you know, it'll get a point for technicals. If it has, you know, we'll follow the street to a certain extent. So we'll look at as much as we can access in terms of analyst information. We'll try and pour over what, you know, people who are following the stock are saying, try and get a balanced view of what the positives and the negatives are. And if it checks, if we feel more compelled by the bull case, then, you know, we'll get a point for, let's say, coverage. Then it'll get maybe another point for, we'll kind of look at the moat that they have. How hard is it for competitors to enter in the industry and disrupt them? If it gets a point there. And as you accumulate these points, basically the number of points you're receiving, different ranges of the total will correspond to different ratings. And then those ratings will then correspond to sizing in our portfolio. And, you know, sizing will vary, obviously, if you're talking about a balanced investor versus, you know, someone who's all equity. You know, the actual absolute value of the position sizes will change, but I mean, in theory, they'll change proportionally to one another. And that's how we kind of overweight or underweight stocks that were, you know, that have already kind of made it through our screening process to be names that we're interested in owning or that we own. That's how we'll then kind of adjust the sizing based on, based on our, you know, trying as much as possible to be unemotional and score them and come up with the ratings.
It sounds like a very systematic process that's based on all the tools that you have access to, which in the market these days, I mean, there's a significant amount of tools and technology that wealth managers can utilize. Certainly, Rob, over your, you know, 20 plus years in the business, I'm sure things have changed dramatically at RBC on the wealth management side. Knowing that, and looking, kind of gazing into your crystal ball, what structural shifts do you see coming for the wealth management industry?
Yeah, no, I love this topic, and you know what, I love talking about it, and I've actually been on a few panels this year on this exact topic, some nationwide panels, and so the key is to, like, for us, like the investment side to a certain extent has been commoditized. Right. So, you know, you have access to ETFs and we all know the facts, you know, 90% of managers over a significant period of time have trouble beating the index. So in many cases, you want to use, you know, ETFs if you don't have access to world-class management process or managers. Obviously, we like to create alpha. So our job is to beat those indexes with a lot less risk. So we have our mandate, but so that I think is secondary. I think the primary thing now is, you know, it's not just about, oh, this is what I have, this is what my investment's doing, and I'll see you next year. And we just had a review, and oh, that's good, you're meeting your goals. It's, I like to call it, you need to provide live planning now. So it has to be interactive. It has to be aspirational. So we're, you know, one of the things we've been doing for quite some while is we've been building these live plans for clients. So virtual plans that can be accessed through portals. And so it's like having a live snapshot of where you are, you know, and based on your goals and where you need to be. And it's very inspirational. And so we're not only talking about the investments, but we're also talking about, you know, things you want to accomplish, your legacy, and so family, education, like that sort of thing. You know, how do we want our family to, you know, what kind of governance do you want if you set up a trust? So these are, I think, the things that technology will enable. We're already doing it as a team. I think the industry is slowly going there, but the ones that forget, you know, or are not inclined to put those, and I'm not just talking about having online access and having tools. That is the commodity. I'm talking about adding the value that the end client needs. So it's connecting the dots. It's helping them see the big picture, removing that emotion, you know? So that is where really tech needs to be used.
Especially, yeah, I think coaching is a very key like aspect as well, right? If, you know, left to their own devices, let's say, we've already talked about how emotion plays a role. So, you know, if you can try and be the coach of clients to try and, you know, get them through, let's say, the more difficult periods that will arise as you're being an investor, and the more difficult to live through periods or the more emotional periods, that's a huge value add. But also, you know, further to what Rob was saying, the financial planning process is kind of outdated in that, and this is an analogy Rob likes to use often, is, you know, you get a plan that's put down on paper, you know, you sit down with a planner, you build your whole, you know, your structure, and you lay out everything about your whole financial situation. They create a snapshot with projections and recommendations, but then, you know, a year from now, either there could have been a change to values, there could have been a change to circumstances, and, you know, that plan is kind of static, right? So if you can try and be like Rob said, live, I guess, where we try and always, you know, always keep the plan or the roadmap, if you will, in place and up to date and you know, kind of relevant to where the client is at any particular time, I think that can add, you know, that can add a lot of value. And we're not just talking about projections, we're talking about, you know, circumstances and things like that, but also constantly updating the projections based on, you know, better than expected performance, worse than expected performance, always making sure that the client has a, you know, a picture of where they're going to end up down the road.
Right. And, you know, it's really interesting observing the development of the wealth management industry over the past 5, 10, 20 years. It's really changed so much, where you mentioned that, you know, the investment side of the business, you know, is highly commoditized. You got index ETFs, this proliferation of various ETF strategies, asset allocation, a robo-advisor, you know, all these different buckets that have really made the investment process simple, automated, and somewhat consistent in terms of expectations. So your role has really grown, you know, far past just the investing side. You mentioned, you know, weighting heavily on the planning side. How has, you know, your role changed over time? And what do you think the main value add of a wealth manager is for, say, a high net worth client these days?
So I think I kind of touched upon it, you know, that AI makes today and obviously, you know, it makes everything, the small things, like, kind of easy. But I think the big picture stuff is where, you know, we need to kind of make an impact, right? So it's the decisions to get people to think about the harder issues, you know? I'm not sure technology is going to help in that. I'm sure it will when it comes to client-facing tools and what the client can see. We have so many ways to, like, our business has changed dramatically. Like, writing an investment piece or a blog, you know, 10 years ago was a big deal. Today we blog constantly. We're constantly on social media. We're doing a podcast with you. We do webcasts all the time. We've done 3 this year. You know, it's a given, right? So I think the big picture stuff, connecting the dots, you know, is where we're going to have to, our industry is really going to have to, you know, sharpen the knife, I guess, and focus on that. How you deliver that, it's going to require expertise, understanding of what these people, you know, believe in and want and need. I talked about procedural trust. The procedural trust is key. You need to have procedures in place so these people know they don't have to think about, you know, what's coming next, this quarter, next month, the next year, you know, what have we accomplished together? What are we going to do next? You know, how are the kids going to get educated? The next generation going to get educated? How are the grandkids going to, like, all these things require procedures. Now, I talk about methodology and procedures in portfolio management, but it could be easily applied to the wealth management side. And that's what we're really, really focused hard on our side.
Great. Now, before I wrap things up on the podcast today, Rob and Jeff, I'm going to put you both on the spot. And I'm going to ask if you could hold one investment for the next 10 years, what would it be? It could be a stock, could be a sector, it could be a strategy. What are your thoughts?
I don't know. I guess I'll take it and I'll let Jeff wrap it up. But I'm, you know, the easy way out would be to say smaller mid-cap growth. I think that's an easy one because, you know, you have the kind of companies that have the potential to be added to the index or added to NASDAQ or added to, you know, that have the ability to grow 10x. And so that's if I had to just, you know, pick a sector, I'd say that small to mid-cap growth would definitely be my pick. But then if we had to talk individual companies, we mentioned many of them on this podcast. I mentioned, Uber, but I think if you're going to, I think Jeff would probably agree, and he brought this to my attention. Just if you're going to go with the best company or the one that you think has the best, best return over time would be Amazon for sure. Jeff, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I'd say Amazon. If I had to pick a single company, I'd probably say Amazon just because, you know, you can talk about, let's say, potential for some of these more small to mid-cap names to grow. But I think, you know, if you're going to really not, you know, be restricted from buying or selling it, or if the story changes or if an industry evolves away from a company, you know, there's always that kind of risk. So I have a hard time saying buy one of those and don't look at it for 10 years. But Amazon, you know, I think at this point they've reached, you know, a point where if ever they do see opportunities or you know, they've already kind of proven, like we talked about earlier, their ability to somewhat be nimble and to adapt business model and to open new avenues for growth. And, you know, with their current size, I think if you're talking about something that has to be a single company just to allow wealth to compound over the next 10 years, I would say Amazon. But in terms of just to go further with what Rob said about smaller mid-cap growth, I would say even rather than just the style, go with a, you know, a manager or a thematic ETF in some kind of theme, whether it's, you know, technology or something like this. One maybe more actively managed that's in that space, where because I think small cap and mid-cap especially is, you know, it's easier for managers, good managers, to add value in let's say those areas. So, you know, it's a lot easier for a company that's a $2 billion market cap today to become a $10 billion than for, you know, Amazon at $2 trillion to become $10 trillion, probably just because of, you know, the law of large numbers at a certain point.
I think it's noteworthy to mention that Amazon, a 10X on Amazon, it becomes a $20 trillion company. That's unheard of. But then again, anything's possible, right?
Yeah, perhaps that will be normal in that. 20 years or so, who knows where things are going to go, but truly appreciate your insights on wealth management and growth investing today. Before I let you go, where can investors find out more about you guys, what you guys do at the Oreo Group?
Sure. So you can look us up at dioriowealthmanagement.com. That's D-I-I-O-R-I-O wealthmanagement.com. That's two I's. We're also on social media. You can connect or follow us, Rob DiOrio, Jeffrey Lin, we post pretty much everything we post for the public is on LinkedIn or Facebook as well.
Okay, great. Well, thanks so much for being on the podcast. I'm sure our listeners will enjoy it very much. So wish you all the best, and we'll chat with you soon.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Thanks for having us.
Bye, everybody.
Thanks for tuning in to the Absolute Return Podcast. This episode was brought to you by Accelerate Financial Technologies. Accelerate, because performance matters. Find out more at accelerateshares.com. The views expressed in this podcast are the personal views of the participants and do not reflect the views of Accelerate. No aspect of this podcast constitutes investment, legal, or tax advice. Opinions expressed in this podcast should not be viewed as a recommendation or solicitation of an offer to buy or sell any securities or investment strategies. The information and opinions in this podcast are based on current market conditions and may fluctuate and change in the future. No representation or warranty, expressed or implied, is made on behalf of Accelerate as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Accelerate does not accept any liability for any direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage suffered by any person as a result of relying on all or any part of this podcast, and any liability is expressly disclaimed.